In West Africa, a coup that rattles Washington, the U.S. has invested heavily in the development of Niger.
And to see it unravel in the span of, 48 hours by a group of a dozen guys with guns, it really, I think, strikes at the heart of this development model.
Also today, the impact of the war in Ukraine on the environment there. When you're focused on missiles coming from the sky, the toxic impacts on the ground, as our reporter learned, are hiding in plain sight.
What do you think that is?
I think you shouldn't go very close because, we shouldn't breathe these materials.
And this World Cup marks a swan song for Brazilian soccer legend Marta.
Marta lived up to the expectations of, she's from the country of soccer.
A country, though, where women playing the game was not appreciated. All that and more coming up today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. Thanks for being with us today. For the past year and a half, we've seen the agony as Russian forces wage war against Ukraine. The biggest costs of this conflict, of course, are the lost human lives. But there are also the cities reduced to rubble. This week on the show, we're focusing on a different cost of this war, one that is often less visible, the impact on the environment. The World's environment correspondent Carolyn Beeler joins me. And Carolyn, you were in Ukraine earlier this summer reporting when the Kakhovka Dam burst. That was probably the most visible example of what we're talking about.
It was. That event really focused global attention for, I would say, the first time on the damage being done to Ukraine's environment by this war. So the water that used to be held in the Kakhovka Reservoir, much of it rushed down the Dnipro River when that dam burst. And that water carried leaked oil, it carried landmines, lots of other contaminants with it. We now know that about 250 square miles of forests were flooded, along with dozens of towns and villages, wetlands, and lots of protected areas. And the Dnipro Delta region is likely to be permanently changed.
Yeah, pretty stunning. So this was the highest profile example of environmental damage during this war, but you saw lots of others. What kinds of impacts are we talking about?
They're really widespread, Marco, and they've been going on since, the very beginning of the full-scale invasion. The Ukrainian government keeps a running tally of the cost of the environmental damage done, and right now it's at more than $56 billion, which is a figure that I'm going to be pulling apart a little bit in a story tomorrow. This includes everything from mowed-down forests impacted by trench warfare to water and soil contaminated by industrial pollutants and spilled oil. This includes agricultural lands that are now rendered unusable because of landmines. There have also been cases of Russian strikes hitting water treatment and sewage facilities, so drinking water being compromised. So the list of environmental impacts is a long one.
A real mess. And I imagine there's been a lot of air pollution as well.
Yeah, this is a really almost invisible one. But as industrial sites or oil and gas infrastructure get blown up, both of which have been targeted throughout this war by Russian forces, that releases a lot of pollutants into the air. One way to think about that is that all of this fighting is releasing nearly as much excess greenhouse gases as the country of Belgium emits in a year.
Incredible. And what about the impacts to soils and agriculture that you mentioned?
Well, shelling leaves behind massive amounts of shrapnel and heavy metals in the soil, something we're going to be looking at a little bit later in the week. But one analysis that has stuck with me from my reporting is that a square kilometer of heavily targeted land could contain something like 500 tons of iron just from shelling alone.
Yeah, and we're about to hear what you found out about that right now in your report, Carolyn. You visited some sites in Ukraine that had been attacked, and you begin your story in the city of Chernihiv in northeastern Ukraine.
On just the fifth day of the war, Russian forces bombed a home improvement store on the edge of the city. Since then, its twisted wreckage has stood largely untouched.
So there's still a sign with their opening hours. But you can just walk right through their busted out front door.
I step over shards of glass with ecologist Katerina Polianska.
Be careful with your shoes.
Polianska has been studying the environmental impact of this war by collecting samples from sites like these around the country. Today, she's picking her way through a wasteland of tangled and rusted metal roofing.
You just see the power of these blasts. This metal looks like it's just kind of melted and crumpled down.
Yeah, and this is an evidence that it was a huge temperature. There were a lot of burning materials inside of this building.
We step around a burned-up fridge and under a piece of metal ductwork hanging precariously from a portion of the roof that's still standing. The first concern here, Polianska says, was air pollution, as the paint, plastic, insulation, and other building materials went up in flames. But now there are other environmental concerns.
We can see there's a lot of ash, and if there's some windy weather, it can just blow up, and people in the nearest buildings, they can breathe these things, and this ash can have some like dioxin, some carcinogenic materials, because of this like unburned plastic and other things.
It's easy to see how this ash can become airborne with just the slightest disturbance.
You're stepping on the dirt and ash here, and it's releasing some dust from beneath your feet.
Yes,
is this like insulation, do you think?
Yeah, it's for heating. It's for insulation.
Polianska says she doesn't think this insulation has asbestos in it, but the carcinogen is widespread in buildings here.
Maybe it can be also this sort of ash and iron.
Polianska wears gloves as she digs with a gardening spade into the rubble, putting samples of burned insulation and something that looks like scorched steel wool into plastic baggies.
What do you think that is?
I think please, you shouldn't go very close because, yeah, we shouldn't breathe these materials. Yeah.
Results Polianska has gotten back from previous field visits have shown huge concentrations of heavy metals and other dangerous materials in the soil underneath burned Russian tanks. So she does not make a habit of lingering at sites like these.
Let's go outside.
This site is just one example of how combat has contaminated Ukraine's environment. In the early days of the invasion, Russian strikes targeted oil depots. More than 30,000 tons of oil has now leaked into water and soil. In the town of Kalinivka, about 20 miles outside of Kyiv, one of those bombed-out oil depots is being rebuilt. It was destroyed by a Russian airstrike last March. The explosion was so big, we were scared even sitting in the basement, says resident Yulia Samohatkata. She hopped off her bike in the middle of town to talk to me. It was burning and smoking for 5 days after they blew up everything, she says. 6,000 tons of oil seeped into the ground and eventually into a nearby lake. Almost a year and a half after the explosion, small oil slicks are still visible on the lake's surface, and residents complain of a foul smell. Ludmila Odinets can see the lake from her house. She says people used to come here from neighboring towns to swim and sunbathe. We used to go there all the time, she says. We used to go fishing there, barbecue, and now we wish we could go to our own backyard without this terrible smell. She worries about the health impacts of the spill. She drinks well water, but it hasn't smelled or tasted funny, so she's gone on drinking it. She understands that during wartime, officials have higher priorities than cleaning all this up. But sooner or later, the war will be over and we'll still have a disaster here, she says. That's the case in many other parts of the country, including large swaths of land set aside for environmental protection. On the very edge of Kyiv, I visit a spot in the Holosivsky National Park where a Russian ballistic missile was shot down a week earlier.
So there's a small impact crater, maybe 15, 20 feet long, and a bunch of charcoal black small trees that have fallen over.
Oleksandr Novitsky, an inspector with the National Park Agency, explained what happened through a translator.
После падіння було загорілось паливо, яке було в ракеті.
When it was shot down, the fuel that was inside the rocket started a fire, and as you can see, the trees have burned out.
The fuel that didn't burn up soaked into the soil.
Точно висадити дерева, воно не поверне цим соснам більше 100 років. Вони загинуть. Тому, ну, це не можна передати.
These pine trees are over 100 years old. They will die. And even the human efforts to replant something, regrow something, will not rectify all the damage that has been done.
This spot is just where one missile landed after being shot down. Old-fashioned trench warfare waged with tanks and heavy artillery has mowed and burned down forests along the more than 600-mile front line in eastern Ukraine.
In a nutshell, the forests are being destroyed.
Igor Grinik is a biologist at the Ukrainian Nature Conservation Group.
Places where intense fighting took place in forests, these forests are no longer forests at all. They look like something on the moon.
Artillery strikes and bombings have also triggered forest fires. According to one analysis, half of the roughly 20,000 wildfires in Ukraine last year occurred within about 40 miles of the front lines.
And of course, it will take decades for the forest to regrow. And in some cases, the ecosystems, there are no possibilities to restore them.
That's true for all of the ecological destruction caused by Russia's war on Ukraine. Some areas will take years to clean up. Others may never come back as they once were.
That was The World's Carolyn Beeler reporting from Ukraine. Carolyn, tomorrow I understand you'll be bringing us back to one of the sites in the story, the destroyed oil depot.
Yeah, that's right. The Ukrainian government has been closely tracking what they see as the cost of environmental damages they're incurring with a very specific aim. So I visited that oil depot with the inspectors who originally assessed it shortly after it was attacked.
I was pretty shocked because in all my career, this is the first time I've seen the disaster of this magnitude.
More from The World's Carolyn Beeler tomorrow on the program. Carolyn, thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
And now a word about life, death, reanimation, and worms.
Hungry.
The scene from SpongeBob SquarePants put the spotlight on one particular kind of worm.
Dang, nematodes!
Nematodes are in the news now because of a scientific paper that came out last week.
This all started when our Russian colleagues dug up a bit of permafrost for their studies. And they found that after thawing this, some nematodes crawled out of it.
Evolutionary biologist Philip Schiffer of the University of Cologne in Germany told Global News about the research. It began with a probe 130 feet below the permafrost in Siberia.
It's kind of a super fascinating finding to suddenly see life, living animals crawling out of a piece of soil that has been deep frozen for 46,000 years.
Yes, the tiny worms had been frozen for 46,000 years. After they thawed, they lived a normal lifespan, which for them is just a few weeks, but long enough for them to reproduce. Now, some 5 years later, that'd be 100 generations in nematode time, this previously unknown species of nematode has been thoroughly investigated, chromosome by chromosome, gene by gene, and scientists have begun to understand how it goes into this kind of suspended metabolism known as cryptobiosis. Research team member Tamaraz Khrishchalia told the CBC that he had studied this adaptation in other creatures.
That nematodes have such a robust system that they can stay in this situation for more or less indefinite times.
Flabbergasting is how he described this discovery.
Because it's unbelievable that life can be stopped for many, many years, and now we know even for millennia. And then it can come back. This is really a miracle.
The team's findings were published last week in the journal PLOS Genetics. The research, still ongoing, may one day reveal how other life forms can be shut down, suspended, then revived when the conditions are just right. When it comes to in-your-face, sometimes graphic warnings about the dangers of cigarette smoking, Canada has long been the vanguard. Now our northern neighbors are taking the health warnings one step further. That's just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. If you buy cigarettes in Canada, don't say you weren't warned. Canada is now the first country in the world to require health warning labels on not just packs, but on individual cigarettes. The warnings are not subtle. Light up and in your face will be words like poison in every puff or cigarettes cause impotence. The new regulations were announced in 2021, took effect today, and will be phased in over the next year or so. Rob Cunningham is senior policy analyst at the Canadian Cancer Society. He's in Ottawa. Rob, what are some of the other messages that will appear on individual cigarettes?
There's going to be a series of six that are going to be rotated equally. Cigarettes damage your organs. Tobacco smoke harms children. Cigarettes cause leukemia. Those are some other examples.
And will they be in English and French on every cigarette?
Yes. Canada's a bilingual country. They'll be in both English and French. Black text on a white background. And they're going to be over where the filter part of the cigarette is.
I mean, there's not a lot of real estate to write each message. I mean, will they be easy to read?
They will. They're going to use capital letters, and you know, these are three or four words. And you know, the size of the text is larger than you'd read in a newspaper. So they'll be very readable. You know, there's been tests that have been done, about 25 studies altogether in Canada and other countries, and find that this would be an effective measure to reduce smoking.
As I gather, it's not on any cigarettes yet. It's going to be phased in according to the type of cigarette. What is the timeline?
Tobacco companies are going to be given 9 months, April 30th, 2024, the deadline for manufacturers to print these warnings on the cigarettes. There's an additional 3 months for retailers. There are some smaller size cigarettes that exist in Canada. They're going to have a bit more time for those particular category of cigarettes.
When this scheme was announced in 2021, was there any pushback?
Well, we know that tobacco companies are not supportive. And for us, it's a signal that we're on the right track. They know that this is going to reduce cigarette sales. This is Canada setting a world precedent. Other countries are inevitably going to follow. Already, Australia and Norway have said that they're looking to follow this Canadian approach. In 2001, Canada was the first country in the world to require pictures as part of health warnings on cigarette packages. Several hundred studies now confirm that this is a valid approach, larger warnings with pictures. And there's 135 countries that have followed this Canadian precedent. Not yet the United States. The United States has tried, but the tobacco companies have tied it up in court.
So how do you feel about this? I mean, is this the end of a campaign you'd been pushing for?
Well, it's certainly not the end. You know, it's a good measure, among others. We've been working on it since 2006. It's going to reach every smoker every day with every cigarette and every puff during every smoke break across the entire country. And for many kids, they experiment by borrowing or obtaining an individual cigarette from a friend. They don't have the warning on the package to see, but they're going to see that warning right on that cigarette. It's going to make cigarettes less attractive. It's going to make them less cool. So kids are really concerned about appearance in terms of their friends. So this is going to reduce youth smoking. And that's one aspect for us that's important.
I did read that part of the logic behind the scheme is due to young people who might be procuring individual cigarettes from a friend or maybe swipe from their parents, as opposed to buying a pack of 20, which would have the warning on the side. How large a percentage of the population, though, is that?
Well, as a percentage of the smokers, it's a smaller part because, you know, most people are aged, you know, 20 to 80 and so on. But the overwhelming majority of smokers began as teenagers. So if we can prevent youth from starting over time, we're going to have a tremendous impact on the total number of people who smoke.
What is the rate of tobacco smoking in Canada currently, and how has it changed over the past 20 or 30 years? And how close are you to that 5%?
Well, we're at 12% for the most recent data in terms of Canadians who smoke. In 1965, it was 50%. So at that time, we were much higher than the United States. So when we were at 50%, the United States was at 42%. Both countries have made important progress, but we just have to keep at it.
Rob Cunningham is senior policy analyst at the Canadian Cancer Society. He's been speaking with us from Ottawa about new regulations that took effect today that require a health warning on every single cigarette sold in Canada. Rob, thank you very much.
Marco, thanks very much. Great to be with you.
In Ecuador, President Guillermo Lasso declared a 60-day state of emergency in all the country's prisons, a response to a gang battle where 31 people died and inmates took nearly 100 guards hostage. It was just one example of a prison where inmates basically took over. As the world's TBS Zaya reports, this is not uncommon in South America and actually has led to mixed outcomes.
Last Wednesday, when armed forces showed up to a major prison in Ecuador after deadly riots, they found a horrifying scene. Dozens of body parts, including human heads, spread around the prison. The situation is becoming all too familiar to Ecuadorians. It's happened multiple times in the past couple of years.
Las cárceles del Ecuador, lo que más hay son armas.
In Ecuador, prisons are full of guns, says Billy Navarrete. He's a human rights activist who's worked in Ecuador's prisons for four decades.
Esa cárcel ha estado caracterizada por la presencia de organizaciones mafiosas.
Criminal gangs operate inside the prisons with the authorities' complicity, he says. Self-governing prisons are very common in Latin America. In Venezuela, the infamous cartel Tren de Aragua that extorts, kidnaps, and traffics people across South America is controlled from a prison. Last fall, journalist Rona Rizquez infiltrated this prison.
Es una cárcel donde hay piscina, hay zoológico, hay discoteca.
There is a zoo, a pool, a nightclub. gambling centers, drug shops, and retail stores that sell luxury items, Rizquez says. But these amenities are not financed by the authorities, but by groups that are behind bars.
La prisión especialmente se financia con una cosa que ellos llaman la causa.
In the case of this prison, Rizquez says, the main revenue comes from an internal tax. It's around $15 a week paid by all the inmates. A small group of people inside the prison gain enough power to administer a yearly budget of $3 million. In many Latin American jails, prisoners have informally established their own governing bodies to keep order. That's according to Sasha Dwork, professor of criminology at the University of Westminster. He's been studying self-governing prisons in Brazil for years.
What you find in South America are places which are hugely underinvested with extraordinary levels of material deprivation.
He says prisons tend to be heavily overcrowded, and in some of them you can find 4 people per square meter. It's in conditions like this that inmates tend to take control.
So you have places where if you took away self-governance in these prisons, then the food wouldn't even arrive at the cells. The self-governance very much is something which is allowed and supported and relied upon, not by the central state, but by the people in prisons. I would call it survival. It's people getting by.
He says not all the self-governing prisons are dangerous.
Because the prisoners are kind of organized, violence doesn't happen so much.
But clashes happen when either authorities or inmates try to change the system that's already in place. And that's what's been happening in Ecuador, says Billy Navarrete.
Y a nadie le queda duda de que la violencia carcelaria está...
There's no doubt that prison riots are connected with an increase in overall violence, he says. Ecuador has the region's 4 highest homicide rate, higher even than Mexico. And many members of competing gangs end up in jail, fighting for power. In the past 2 years there, more than 400 prisoners have been killed. For The World, I'm Tibisa Isaiah.
More global news still coming your way this hour. You're listening to The World. The spiral of violence continues in Haiti. Now, Kenya, a country with limited experience in security assistance, is sending police to help.
If any security force comes in now, you run the risk of that peacekeeping operation going into conflict with the population.
Trying to keep the peace in Haiti ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. It is crunch time at the FIFA Women's World Cup. Teams are fighting to make it out of the group stage and into the knockout round. Canada, the reigning Olympic champions, got bounced yesterday by host country Australia. And the U.S., the reigning World Cup champs, almost bowed out of it this morning.
Headed forward, look out there! A break, a shot, off the post!
In the 92nd minute, Portugal's shot on goal deflected off the right post, keeping Team USA's World Cup dreams alive. Former U.S. midfielder Carly Lloyd commented that it didn't look like her old team was playing with much passion.
The player of the match was that post. You were lucky to not be going home right now.
The game ended in a scoreless draw. The U.S. plays again on Sunday. Still a lot of soccer to come before then, though, with athletes spanning the soccer generations. One of the youngest players is 18-year-old Linda Caicedo of Colombia. Over the weekend, she scored what's already being billed as the goal of the tournament. She dribbles and dances around 1, 2, 3 German defenders, then places the ball perfectly in the upper corner of the net.
Onegas had it. Here's Caicedo. Sneaks free! Caicedo!
And then there are the veterans. One of the biggest names is, of course, Marta, the powerhouse forward who has represented Brazil in 6 World Cups. This one, she says, is her last. The World's Bianca Hillier reports on Marta's journey to the top and the legacy she's going to leave behind.
Over her decades on the pitch, Marta has grown so popular and well-known across the globe that to most people, she's simply Marta.
Marta makes a mark!
But when she arrived in Rio de Janeiro to try out for Vasco da Gama's women's team in 1999, she was Marta da Silva, just a young girl from a small town in northeastern Brazil. Coach Elena Pacheco was there when Marta first stepped onto the field.
Ela não falava quase nada, era muito tímida, mas só olhava para a bola no primeiro dia, não fez o teste, fez apenas...
Pacheco says Marta was very shy at first and just looked at the ball. So Pacheco showed her the basics and the rest is history.
Então, a gente notou que ela era um diamante bruto desde os primeiros treinos que ela fez.
Pacheco says she noticed Marta was a diamond in the rough from the very first training session. Her technical skills were just that good.
Ela já mostrou muita raiva da vida.
On top of that, Marta also stood out for her courage and determination to win no matter what. At just 14 years old, she signed with Vasco da Gama and led the team to a championship win in her first year. Pacheco has since been credited with discovering Marta, but it would take leaving Brazil for the soccer star to become a household name. To the delight of fans, Marta played her first game in Sweden in 2004 after signing a contract with a pro team there. Pacheco says taking this leap was a big deal.
Bom, o mais importante é que ela saiu do Brasil e foi para a Suécia. Isso foi fundamental para a evolução dela como atleta.
The move was crucial to Marta's evolution as an athlete, she says, because Brazil didn't have the systems in place that Marta would need to become an icon in women's soccer. So Marta was effectively forced to build success elsewhere. And that's exactly what she did.
Well, you can't contain a talent like that. Absolutely breathtaking, Marta.
Over her decades-long career, Marta has scored the most goals in Brazil's history, the most World Cup goals in world history, and she was the first player to ever score in five consecutive Olympics. Gabi Kivitz, who used to play pro soccer in Brazil, says these accomplishments are even more impressive than they sound at face value.
Marta lived up to the expectations of, like, she's from the country of soccer. But what some people don't understand is that she was able to achieve that in a context where, like, female soccer was not appreciated at all.
Kivitz says soccer has long been viewed as a man's sport in Brazil. Brazilian women were even banned from the field for nearly four decades. And even after making a name for herself, Marta was often called Pelé with a skirt. That history, which impacted all women in Brazil, is told in the song Jogadeira, which has become a sort of anthem for athletes across the country.
Essa música é dedicada a todas aquelas meninas que sonham em ser jogadora de futebol.
Kivitz co-wrote the song and translates it for me.
Desde pequena, muito preconceito, aqueles papo futebol não é pra mulher.
That means since I was a little girl, I went through a lot of prejudice and people saying this is not for women. You say soccer is not for girls, like you're tripping. Just play a ball to my feet and I'll show you what I can do.
That's the tactic Marta has always taken. She's let her moves on the pitch do the talking, and it has worked. At a press conference in Melbourne today, Marta got emotional, reflecting on the progress she's seen over her career.
Sabe o que é legal? É que quando eu comecei a jogar, eu não tinha ídolo no feminino. Vocês não mostravam o jogo no feminino.
She said when she started playing, she didn't have any women to look up to in the sport. Now she gets stopped on the street by parents saying their daughter loves her and wants to be just like her.
Isso não teria acontecido se a gente tivesse parado nos primeiros obstáculos.
This would not have happened, she said, without persistence from her and the women who came before her. Kivitz says because of that hard work, Marta's legacy will transcend soccer.
She will always be respected, and people will never forget what she did for the sport and for the country.
You can watch Marta in her final World Cup tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. Eastern time, when Brazil takes on Jamaica in Melbourne. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
In In West Africa, there's a serious realignment of alliances underway. Niger is a stalwart U.S. ally, but now a military coup has thrown that partnership into question. Some of Niger's neighbors are talking about intervening to restore the democratically elected government. Other neighbors say that would be an act of war. To understand all this, we called Cameron Hudson. He's a former CIA officer and an official within the National Security Council. Cameron's now at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. First of all, Cameron, I want to understand the U.S. interest in Niger. In what ways has Niger been an important intelligence and military ally for the U.S.?
The United States maintains two drone bases inside of Niger from which we are able to collect intelligence over rebels in southern Libya, the civil war in Sudan, the Boko Haram terrorist group in Nigeria. And so it's an incredibly powerful platform. If you look at the map of Africa, and of course, these threats that we face, Niger is right geographically in the center of all of this. And so having bases in Niger allows us access basically from the Red Sea to the Mediterranean to the Atlantic. I think the second way we're working with the Nigerians is on the ground. We are in a long-term train and assist program working with the counterterrorism unit of the Nigerian armed forces, helping them to battle an encroachment of terrorist threats from both Al-Qaeda and ISIS offshoots, which have, you know, really beset the region across the Sahel.
Was the coup against ousted President Mohamed Bazoum a surprise to the U.S. intelligence community?
I think to a lot of people, it was a surprise. I think there was a sense in Washington, certainly, that Niger was pretty firmly in the democratic camp. They had had a successful democratic transition between two democratically elected heads of state. The intelligence assets that we have are really trained on a counterterrorism target. And I think we are probably not collecting on the internal political machinations of the Nigerian political scene, right? That is probably a blind spot for U.S. intelligence officers. And frankly, I think it shows the weakness of the approach, because you can invest billions of dollars creating intelligence platforms in this country, but if you're not sensitive to the political context, the local circumstances in which you are operating, then the whole thing can be undone in a matter of hours.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken voiced unwavering support for deposed Mohamed Bazoum, the former president. The regional organization ECOWAS supports Bazoum as well, and it's discussing an intervention. Does a military intervention seem any more likely to you today than it was yesterday?
No, in fact, it feels less likely today than it did yesterday. In the intervening time since ECOWAS has threatened a military intervention to restore President Bazoum, we have seen a coalition of Sahelian states that includes Mali and Burkina Faso essentially announce that they would come to the military assistance of Niger should other states in the region try to intervene to reinstall Bazoum. Now, these states that are allying with Niger right now are coup governments themselves in both Mali and Burkina Faso. So what we're seeing here now is a real division of the regional organization ECOWAS along military and democratic lines, which is, you know, fracturing this institution and this organization in ways that it hasn't been before.
So Cameron, sounds like that's going to be one thing you're going to be watching as the situation in Niger evolves. I mean, global shot, what most interests you about this whole story? What's the narrative you're following?
Well, I think the thing that is most striking to me is, you know, we call these countries fragile states. That's the sort of World Bank development lexicon. But I think that this is really the quintessential example of what a fragile state is, that the West can pump in literally billions of dollars into this country over the past decade, supporting not just democratic institutions, but their response to climate change, gender and youth engagement, all of the kind of political institution building that we do. I mean, Niger is the recipient of all of the kind of marquee development programs that we have in the U.S. government toolkit. And to see it unravel in the span of, you know, 48 hours by a group of a dozen guys with guns who are disgruntled about the toys that they have received and about their promotions and things like that, it really, I think, strikes at the heart of this development model that the West has been, you know, pushing onto these African countries. If it can be undone that quickly by that few people, then what have we gotten for the billions of dollars that we have been investing in these places over time? I think it's a time for real self-reflection about how we go about trying to build strong and resilient democracies in this part of the world.
Cameron Hudson is a former CIA officer and National Security Council official who's focused on Africa. He's now at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Cameron, thank you very much. This is really insightful.
Thanks very much.
The gang violence in Haiti continues to be a massive challenge there. Last week, the U.S. Embassy actually took the precaution of withdrawing its non-emergency staff. For months, there's been talk of an international intervention in Haiti, and now Kenya, thousands of miles away in East Africa, is offering to lead. Kenya says it's willing to send 1,000 police to Haiti for security assistance. This makes Kenya the first country to make such a proposal since Haiti's president was assassinated 2 years ago. Daniel Foote is a former special envoy to Haiti. We reached out to him for some perspective on what role international forces could play in Haiti.
Well, first, I think it's great that somebody at least is stepping up to the table. I would give Kenya kudos for that. Kenya, as you know, I was an ambassador in Africa. And while they've participated in peacekeeping operations under the UN and the African Union, as of the end of last September, had 349 personnel in UN peacekeeping missions. So it's not like they have a big cadre of trained peacekeeping staff. I don't think Kenya is the right nation to lead such a mission because of their lack of experience.
Well, I mean, is military intervention even the right thing to be talking about?
If any security force comes in now backing the illegitimate U.S.-appointed de facto Prime Minister Ariel Henry, you run the risk of that peacekeeping operation going into conflict with the population, because the population does not want Ariel Henry in control, and they would see potentially a security mission as propping him up. So as long as he's there, I really worry that any intervention is going to be very risky and dangerous.
The conventional wisdom has been that Haitians don't want international intervention, but have we seen that opinion shift in the past 2 years as the security situation has gotten worse?
Yes, and I'm still a little uncomfortable speaking for the Haitians on this. As of a year ago, the feeling on the ground was still, no, we don't want an intervention, forget about it, we know how it goes. In the last few months, it's much more dire, and my contacts on the ground almost unanimously are asking for help, saying, look, we can't go to buy bread or groceries. We can't live our lives without somebody coming in and helping us. So it's at the point now where the people are on the ground know that they need help, but they also don't want help through Ariel Henry. So it's a bit of a predicament.
Ambassador Foote, I want to understand the weeks leading up to the U.S. diplomatic corps leaving Haiti. What pushed the U.S. over the edge?
With the violence continued to spiral in Port-au-Prince, a fairly robust group of Haitians breached the U.S. Embassy compound last week and got onto the compound, and local police were brought in and they were tear gassed and taken off the compound. And I believe that made Washington very nervous, and they evacuated all but their most essential staff out of Port-au-Prince.
And Daniel, where does this leave Haiti in terms of communicating with the U.S., which is, of course, a key partner?
Well, we still have a chargé d'affaires and some emergency staff in Port-au-Prince. We lose a lot of our intel, information, and influence when we're not in the country. Now, Haiti's different because, again, we've been locked down. The other thing that comes in here is it's exceptionally costly. And now you're looking at flying hundreds of staff out of the country and paying hotels and per diem for months up to a year. You're talking about tens of millions of dollars in taxpayer money to evacuate that embassy.
Daniel Foote was a special envoy to Haiti. Ambassador, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure, Marco. Thank you as always.
At the age of 78, Aung San Suu Kyi, Myanmar's best-known political prisoner, will spend slightly less time in prison. She had been sentenced to 33 years for offenses that her supporters say were an attempt to discredit her. Today, the military-led government reduced her sentence. She now has 27 years left to serve. The clemency is part of Myanmar's observance of a religious holiday that commemorates the day the Buddha gave his first sermon. More than 7,000 prisoners were pardoned. it was not immediately clear if any of the released prisoners included political detainees. All right, what do these three artists have in common?
Look at the stars, look how they shine for you.
She wears short skirts, I wear t-shirts. She's cheer captain and I'm on the bleachers. Dreaming about the world. I'm drowning in the night. Oh, what I'm like this, you're the one night.
The Weeknd, preceded there by Taylor Swift and Coldplay, some of their biggest hits were written and or produced by Sweden's Music Machine. Lots of other international recording stars look there too. Sweden is the third largest exporter of pop music in the world after the US and the UK. But some in the music industry there worry that the country's changing political climate is threatening its export hit machine. From Stockholm, the world's Europe correspondent Orla Barry has more.
It's 10 a.m. on a weekday morning, and already a long queue has formed outside the ABBA Museum in Stockholm. There's a group of elderly Swedes with walkers and walking sticks who break out into ABBA tunes every so often, and families with young kids too.
Perfect. So, ladies and gentlemen, the intro movie starts.
A tour of the museum starts with the story of ABBA's recent return to the stage after almost 40 years. It's not the actual band members, though, but digital avatars that appear on stage.
Will the audience react as if we actually were there? That's the million-dollar question.
It's not hard to see why many give credit to ABBA for making Sweden a superpower in the pop music world.
I think people, like, in every genre, is proud of the Swedish legacy of ABBA and Max Martin, no matter what genre you're in.
This is Lynn Wexel. She helps run a record label in Sweden called Milkshake. Max Martin, that Wexel mentions, is without a doubt Sweden's most famous music producer. Max Martin song, and this one too, that he co-wrote with Katy Perry, pretty much launched her career. To put his success in context, Max Martin has written more number one hits in the US than anyone else, except for Lennon and McCartney.
We keep on hearing all the time about Max Martin and ABBA, like songwriters that are doing well, Roxette, Ace of Base, people like that throughout my whole lifetime. So I felt like, yeah, why not me too?
Nia is a well-known singer-songwriter here in Sweden. She's talking to me over the phone because, like almost everyone else in Stockholm right now, she's at her summer home in a forest somewhere outside the capital.
I'm out for a walk, so I was like, let's chat now if it works for you.
Nia has written songs with several well-known European artists like Axwell, Swedish singer Zara Larsson and British rapper Tiny Tempa. What's been her secret to success? She says it's the Swedish education system that got her started on her music career.
We have free schooling, so you can afford to go to music school. Like, it's not like in America where your parents maybe have saved money your whole life to go to university. And if you choose to do music with that money and fail, it's a chance you can't really take.
In Sweden, most kids start learning music at a very young age, going to what are known as kulturskolan, literally cultural schools. These are music schools that kids attend after regular school, where they get to learn to play an instrument or sing. And they're practically free. The schools are mainly funded by the local councils. But last November, Sweden's new right-wing coalition announced that state support for these schools would be cut in half.
In the long term, I think it would have a very dramatic impact, actually, because if you ask Swedish artists and Swedish musicians about their background, an extremely high percentage have a background in these kinds of schools.
This is Swedish conductor Sofia Winiarski. We meet in a park in central Stockholm. Winiarski says while politicians like to talk up the success of the Swedish music industry, they seem to forget how so many musicians got started in their careers.
artists are continuously forced to point out that this music wonder didn't grow out of a vacuum, that there's an ecosystem and an infrastructure that is, well, pretty fragile. And if we start sort of tearing down aspects of it, we don't know if we'll still have this music miracle.
She says this government is more interested in promoting more traditional Swedish music. One of the most successful international artists to come out of Sweden in recent years is just about the opposite of all that. In central Stockholm, a museum called the Avicii Experience is dedicated to the life of the famous music producer. There's a replica of Avicii's childhood bedroom, complete with a discarded pizza box and a guitar, and a mixing desk where you can create your own remix of his songs. The museum also reflects on Avicii's sudden death. He took his own life in 2018 at the age of 28. Caroline Fogelin is head of exhibitions at the museum. She says being open about Avicii's mental health struggles is really important, and she's calling on Swedish schools to feature the artist and the Avicii Experience as part of their curriculum.
The ambition is that it is a must-have in Swedish schools. So as much as it's important to have a lecture about mental health, the important part is also to include the music in education.
After all, Fogelin says, Avicii continues to have a huge global influence on artists today. Songwriter Nia tells me she's often asked what's in the water in Sweden, that the country produces so many successful artists. In the last few years, Nia has turned her hand to singing too. Some say you will love me one day, and I will wait to get your love in one day. Just say you will love me one day, and I will wait to get your love in one day. That hit, called Some Say, has clocked up almost 400 million listens on Spotify, which of course was also founded by a Swede. Nia says sometimes just saying you're Swedish appears to open doors in the music business.
It's really unfair, but I'm happy it's that way because I'm Swedish, but like, it's definitely a good thing in music rooms abroad to say that you're Swedish.
But still, it's a tough industry, she says, and it would be great if the Swedish government was behind us. For the world, I'm Orla Barry, Stockholm. Some say you will love me one day, and I will wait to get your love in one day.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you again tomorrow.